This week, for the first time in U.S. history, a former president could face criminal charges. We'll discuss why Donald Trump soon expects to be arrested. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin for alleged war crimes committed in Ukraine. Are the walls closing in on Putin and the Kremlin? We'll discuss these stories in our reporter segment. Also, mass protests rock Kenya and South Africa. In both countries, there are calls for the presidents to step down. Why has the political climate in these nations reached a boiling point? Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome. I'm Heidi Adams. We're coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. It's so great to be with you. For the first time in U.S. history, a former president may be formally charged with a crime. And Russian President Vladimir Putin is a wanted man. What does the ICC's arrest warrant mean for him and for Russia? It's time now for our reporters segment. And joining me here in studio are Carol Van Dam Falk from VOA's English to Africa News Service, and also with us is Misha Komodowski. He's the White House correspondent for VOA's Russia News Service. Misha and Carol, thank you so much for being here. Warm welcome to you. And Misha, I'm going to start out with you. This arrest warrant was not just issued for Vladimir Putin alone, but what has the reaction been in the Kremlin and at the White House to the ICC warrants?
Well, Heidi, thank you for having me. Let me ask you first, who said the following words, if I may quote them. The International Court makes an enormous contribution to the matter of preventing international conflict and the peaceful resolution of a dispute which have already arisen. And ultimately, your activities facilitate the affirmation of international justice. Who is that? Any guess?
Well, I wasn't expecting to be answering questions but...
It's Vladimir Putin. It's Vladimir Putin, right. But like in 2005, while he was visiting another international court in the Hague, literally like... This shows how the world has changed since then. You know, now Vladimir Putin himself is...
And how Putin has changed.
A suspect within the international judicial system. So the Russian state propaganda was trying to diminish this news, and they were reporting mainly the Kremlin's reaction to this without, like, stating the facts. And they were referring to this as the arrest warrant in the quotes, trying to literally diminish this case. And Russia's top investigative agency has opened an investigation into this, and they're saying that that the court basically was violating Russian law by including charging knowingly the person who is innocent, meaning that Vladimir Putin is innocent, according to them. So it literally stirred some pot in Russia, and the state propaganda machine was actively reacting to this case.
And at the White House?
At the White House, well, the President Biden was super short, but was straight to the point. He said that Vladimir Putin committed some war crimes, and he has to be responsible for that. He has to bear some responsibility here. So, and the United States, like the sources from the White House that I talked to, they say that the White House is going to be helping all the international judicial bodies, like the ICC, to collect some evidence and to proceed with the hearings, with the whole procedure, which seems to be quite long.
Misha, thank you for that quiz and for that answer. Carol, former U.S. President Donald Trump suggested on social media at the weekend that he could be indicted Tuesday. Now, this was Tuesday past, and called for protests. Now, Tuesday came and went. No arrests and no protests that we saw out on the streets. What exactly is the former president being accused of, and could he still be arrested?
So he could still be arrested, and that is still in play. Charges have not been filed, but there has been this grand jury investigation going on for quite a while now, and it has to do with hush money to an adult film actress. He has denied all the charges that have been in the media all this time, but his former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, has testified. He has also spent time in prison for what he said previously. Then he came back and said, no, it is true that we did pay hush money. He paid it out of his own money. Then he got reimbursed, he said, by the former president. So we are hearing that that is coming to fruition. And the former president went to social media on Saturday and said, I'm going to be arrested, probably in New York, on Tuesday. And then in capital letters, he said, protest. This is unfair. And it was basically a move to fire up his base, everyone agrees. And he has done that. There are reports that he collected $1.5 million since that tweet went out on Saturday. So he's definitely declared already for the presidential race. And this will, you know, help him position himself for the GOP nomination.
And this is a case that started well before the 2016 election, correct?
Right. And also, which is important to note, it would be really precedent-setting that a former president is charged with criminal charges. It's never happened before in our country. And also, on the same time, that parallel investigation is going on with the U.S. Justice Department, not to do with that hush money, but to do with those White House papers that were found, those documents that were classified documents at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, where he now lives.
Well, it would be unprecedented indeed. Misha, we saw Chinese President Xi Jinping visit Moscow this week. We aren't seeing many other world leaders do the same. How does this warrant really impact Vladimir Putin's world and the very near future for him?
Well, in this case, we have to take a look at Vladimir Putin in a global context. So back last February, he was trying to take over the entire state of Ukraine. He was trying to quickly install a favorable regime to him. And basically, this war has obviously become like a burden, if I say so, for him. It's obviously a complicated, super complex conflict for him. And he's lost vast numbers of men there, and he's lost the faith of the international community. And of course, he's trying to gain some support from his soon-to-be allies. He's trying to befriend Iran. He's trying to befriend North Korea to acquire some weapons for the battlefield. And, you know, like, he's aiming to get China's back.
Right.
And on top of that, now he's a war criminal. I mean, at least he's a suspect in this case. So, like, it's like a layer cake, you know? It adds on another layer, and in general, like, as a whole, it puts a lot of pressure on the Kremlin.
And it literally, nearly just the allegations alone
true,
hangs over them, right?
Yeah, and, like, and that's why the ICC basically made this warrant public. Because they were aiming to basically prevent any other wrongdoings from the Kremlin in the future. And literally today we saw some shelling of the city of Zaporizhia, like the residential complexes that are not obviously the military objects. So the war is still going on, but
these worlds becoming smaller?
Yeah.
Wow. Carol, back to U.S. politics, the 2024 presidential race already shaping up, at least on the Republican side. President Trump, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, they've officially entered the race to be the GOP nominee. Given now the former president's legal battles and the fact that he remains a controversial figure inside the GOP with a large support base, who inside the Republican Party, that's notable, is supporting him and who has not come to his defense?
Well, interestingly, yes, Nikki Haley has, you know, declared her run for the presidency in February. She's the only other one that has declared besides Mr. Trump. And a lot of the odds-on favorites say that his biggest contender is going to be the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis.
Right.
Now, they were very close years ago, but after the insurrection, after other things surfaced, Ron DeSantis has kind of like, you know, chiseled out his own path forward, but he doesn't want to alienate the Trump base.
Right.
And so he's got this kind of tricky path forward for what everybody believes is going to be his run for the president, too.
Wow, it's going to be a tightrope indeed. Very interesting to watch on both fronts. Misha, Carol, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for coming in here and speaking to us. Well, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa. As protests rock their countries, President William Ruto of Kenya and South African President Cyril Ramaphosa are facing calls to step down. We will look at what's led up to the frustration and outrage in these two countries. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back. This week saw mass protests in South Africa and East Africa. In South Africa, thousands took to the streets in a so-called national shutdown over the country's deepening power and unemployment crises. Opposition leader Julius Malema and his opposition Economic Freedom Front led the demonstrations. He and his supporters are calling for President Cyril Ramaphosa to step down. South Africa's central bank estimates the country loses more than $50 million a day in GDP due to the electricity crisis. It's projected to cost the country around $13 billion this year alone. Well, joining me now is Govan Wittels. He's a correspondent with VOA affiliate station Newsroom Africa, and he joins me from Johannesburg. Govan, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. So great to see you. Tell me, the opposition EFF says this was a peaceful yet vibrant protest. The ruling ANC says it was anarchy. How did the national shutdown go down in South Africa this week?
Well, it certainly wasn't anarchy. The protest happened, and despite over 500 arrests happening, there was no major damage to property. There wasn't anyone who was hospitalized due to the shutdown. But there were significant disruptions to economic activity in South Africa, with major routes being closed and the EFF's members attempting to block the movement of key minerals to the country's ports for exports. And they didn't manage to stop anyone from exiting or coming into the country, which was their objective. So the shutdown happened as the EFF hoped it would, but it certainly didn't happen as they promised it would. They said that this shutdown would make the riots of June 2021 look like a picnic. That's certainly not what happened. In fact, the deployment by the police made sure that this shutdown was little more than marches being conducted by the EFF and its allied organizations, its supporters across the country. But by and large, they managed to bring the country to a standstill because we had experienced a public holiday the following day, and most people had already taken leave for the Monday for when the shutdown was scheduled. The ANC says it was anarchy because they had called on all economic activity to be halted by members of the EFF. The police reported over 24,000 tires that had been confiscated, which apparently was going to be used or burnt by the EFF supporters during their shutdown. And of course, that didn't happen either. So it was successful in measure, but also unsuccessful in that it didn't achieve a complete shutdown of the country.
And politically, Govan, what did these protests actually accomplish? Yes, of course, it was to express outrage and frustration over the electricity crisis, but there were also calls for President Cyril Ramaphosa to step down. So politically, what was actually achieved here?
Well, what was firstly achieved was the EFF's ability to forge a new alliance with a number of smaller South African political parties, some of them in parliament, such as the African Transformation Movement, the Pan-Africanist Congress, and then others out of parliament, such as the African People's Convention and the newly formed African Radical Economic Transformation Alliance, that party born out of the supporters of former President Jacob Zuma, who had been kicked out of the ANC. Some of them left because of the outcomes of the national conference. And what we see developing here is a sort of new coalition of parties who are committed to following the EFF onto a path of attempting to remove the president from office through mass protest. What we saw yesterday was the first of such events. Today, we're seeing the South African Federation of Trade Unions conducting another picket in Pretoria outside the High Court, calling for the same demand, essentially that load shedding be ended. But more specifically, they want the president to resign from office. So politically, the EFF seems to have identified its partners on the road to the next elections, and it's clear that they will try to form a new alliance. But they also failed to get the president out of office, although they set a precedent by protesting outside State House, something that's not common here in South Africa.
Excellent reporting there, Govan. Thank you so much. Govan Whittles is a broadcaster from VOA's affiliate television station Newsroom Africa, joining us there from Johannesburg. Govan, thank you again. Well, in Kenya, thousands of opposition supporters have demonstrated in anti-government protests. Opposition leader Raila Odinga led the protests, he claims, without evidence that President William Ruto did not win last year's presidential elections. Odinga and his supporters say the Ruto government is illegitimate and blames that government's policies for the country's high cost of living. Odinga has vowed to continue his protest campaign. And let's take a closer look now at the anger we're seeing on the streets in both countries. My guests are Ziyanda Stierman in Cape Town, South Africa. Ziyanda is a senior Southern Africa analyst for the Eurasia Group. And also with us from New York is David Monda. He is a professor of political science at City University of New York. Ziyanda and Professor David Monda, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. And Prof, I'm going to start with you. The protests in Kenya this week saw dozens of people arrested and one person killed. Now, this is the first outbreak of political violence since the election outcome that saw William Ruto take office last August. Why, Professor, is this happening now?
I think it's partly a bigger question around three main issues that, I'd like to frame. In that context, one of them is electoral reform. Second one is broader issues of governance. And obviously, the third one is economic reform. So post-election, there's been high inflation, lack of access to dollars, and high debts. So that's really affected the economy because Kenya is paying its foreign debt in dollars, but with a depreciating shilling. So there's big issues around economic reform. There's other questions around governance, and in that I'll also add the question of electoral reform, which you are alluding to, the fact that Odinga's claiming, he rightfully won the election, but, the government claims otherwise. So there's a lot of back and forth around the Electoral Commission. But more broadly is the broader issue of the rule of law. And, and here we see questions around police brutality during the demonstrations, but also questions around government corruption and misuse of public funds and how the government, the Ruto government, promised in its election manifesto to cut down on spending. But Kenyans today, even with the economic pains, they still see a lot of government waste and a lot of government spending. An example I'd give here is the appointment of 50 chief administrative secretaries, which is going to cost the country $7 million a year, about $35 million over the cycle of Ruto's government's presidency. So the public in demonstrating, lastly, the public in demonstrating really feel that disaffected because there's economic problems on the ground, but the government's still living large. And I think this is partly, in addition to some of the other factors, an issue that's led to this explosion of public anger on the streets.
An explosion of public anger indeed, Professor. Ziyanda, in South Africa, the country has a new electricity minister who says the power crisis is likely to get worse. I mean, that's hardly what you want to hear from the person who was specifically appointed to fix the problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, I think that of course, this is very disappointing to hear from the electricity minister, somebody who's really been charged with taking control of the situation and making it better, particularly over the next 12 to 18 months. But I think that there is also a recognition of the honesty that's been needed with the entire electricity supply crisis in the country. You know, instead of there being, you know, the typical political speak of this will be solved in the next 6 months, or, you know, the power utility in the country, Eskom, just needs more money or needs more time. There is a little bit more honesty coming both out of the union buildings with Ramaphosa, as well as the new electricity minister now, being honest about the challenges that Eskom faces and the entire electricity sector really faces, especially, I think, ahead of the winter, which is meant to start in the country in about May. So it's not good news for now, for sure, but at least more honesty.
Ziyanda, very brief follow-up. Is being honest about an obvious crisis in the country enough, though?
Definitely not. But it's better than the sort of false hope that I think, you know, really characterized the situation. You know, South Africa has had load shedding since 2008 and essentially been told at various intervals that in the next 12 months, in the next 24 months, you know, once these mega power stations will be built, that load shedding will be a thing of the past. And we're obviously 15 years down the line, and that hasn't been proven to be true.
Professor, I want to go back to the situation in Kenya. You wrote an op-ed in The Citizen in which you say, if demonstrations solved public problems, Kenya would be a superpower. Please explain to us what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is there seems to be a disconnect in terms of the public policy-making framework in Parliament on both the government and the opposition side and street demonstrations. So the opposition's very hell-bent on street demonstrations, but this is actually exacerbating the situation because the country is losing money every time you have demonstrations, particularly in Nairobi as the main city. But I think more broadly, demonstrations are ultimately supposed to be a last resort to public policy questions. And what I was saying when that op-ed is really the elements or the institutions of parliament, the legislature, which are there to actually debate ideas and fix public policy problems, those avenues have not been exhaustively used. And currently, the opposition is now saying they're going to do demonstrations twice a week, every week. So I think we're in for a lot more sort of political drama on the streets. And I was really making the point that a lot of this debate should be not a debate of throwing stones on the street, but more a debate of ideas in parliament.
Also, Ziyanda, speaking of political drama here, we're just a little bit over a year away from elections in South Africa. And I kind of like that phrase that load shedding could lead to vote shedding for the ANC. Where are the greatest political threats here? For the ANC at the polls next year or for President Cyril Ramaphosa inside the ruling ANC?
I think that's an incredibly interesting question. And, you know, so much of what public polls are definitely picking up is a frustration with load shedding, really coming to the fore as a frustration or running out of patience with the ANC. At the very same time, Ramaphosa is a lot more popular, about 10 points popular on most polls than the ANC itself. So you really see the party realizing that if they want to retain their majority in the country, and especially at the polls, that they can't let Ramaphosa go. So there's very clear frustration with him. There's the entire Palapala scandal involving a theft at his private commercial farm that hangs over him. But I think he is safe for now. But post-elections, we may see something different.
Right, right. Professor, these sort of anti-government protests that we're seeing in Africa are part of a global trend we're seeing. I mean, look at what happened in Asia, in Sri Lanka last year, the protests that actually saw the president fleeing the country. And we've seen protests and strikes in France that saw President Macron narrowly survive a vote of no confidence. What is the takeaway here for countries in Africa, like South Africa, like Nigeria, like Kenya?
I think the takeaway here is governance is key. For example, in Kenya, as I'd mentioned, the electoral reform. In South Africa, you know, we've been dealing with a broader question of state capture and how that affects public policy. Nigeria, obviously, issues around oil and the misuse of oil wealth. But even here in the United States, your earlier caption, you spoke about the Trump crisis. We're probably going to wait for his indictment today here in New York City. Again, broader questions around governance and corruption in government. So I think really broadly around the world, you see this big need of the public really crying out for better governance and management around public policy questions and trying to hold political leaders and political elites accountable for public policy questions.
Zianda, very briefly, what's your take on the message here for countries in Africa, given what we're seeing globally?
I think, honestly, the core message is really that dealing with problems or kicking the can down the road by successive administrations really leads to a situation where, parties can no longer just campaign on either doing the bare minimum in terms of, addressing issues at the margins. They actually have to come in at the start of a term and make a difference. Otherwise, really, we're in a situation where people are losing patience political parties and certainly using their democratic rights to express that frustration.
Professor David Monda, are we likely to see things get worse before they get better? Do you have faith that they will get better and that those in power are actually listening and seeing and watching closely what they are seeing on the streets?
I think it depends on the context and the situation. Right. So, for example, if you talked about the U.S. context, it's still very uncertain about what Trump's indictment would lead to. It will further probably polarize the country. In a situation in Kenya, we have this difference in views in terms of the opposition and the current government. So at this point, there's a lot of conversations about backroom deals to try and bring the political leaders together. And obviously, in South Africa's case, to what extent will the ANC continue to lose its large majority, this large electoral majority that's had, and how will the EFF become stronger, as we go into, an election year? So broadly, I think the contexts are different, but the consequences, will also be different based on the different countries and how these political elites act in relation to these broader questions of governance.
Zianda, we're looking ahead, as I asked you earlier, to the polls in South Africa. What is your view, and very briefly, will we see this crisis make people turn out to vote? Because we see antipathy, perhaps, in some of the protests that we've seen around it. But is this crisis going to make people just accept and give up, or is this actually what will drive people to the polls?
I think it will energize people. It's certainly energized the opposition parties in the country. We've seen the DA also marching at the end of January, the largest opposition party calling for an end to load shedding and launching litigation to try and do that. The EFF has now marched, and I think we can really expect that there'll be more marches, more energy, and more mobilizing turnout from the opposition parties, but also even within the ANC. This because of the load shedding crisis, it's, as you were saying, led to these poll numbers showing that the ANC may lose their majority for the first time since 1994. And I think that's definitely going to energize the party in and of itself to put up a very competitive election campaign.
Lots of news to look out for, lots of things to work through. But thank you very much, Ziyanda Stearman and Professor David Monda. Thank you for your insights and for your time. And that is our show this week. Thank you so much to my guests for joining me. And thanks to you, our audience, for joining us on television, radio and online. And be sure to follow us on social media. Thank you for always watching and for always listening. And I will see you next time. Goodbye.